As you know, the theme of this conference is the three T's of evidence-based policing: targeting, testing, and tracking. But there is a fourth T that I think we can make an umbrella T for turning knowledge into action. And it has been suggested to me by the best possible source, who is the leader, in my view, of translational criminology for policing, and that is Cynthia Long, who suggests that the fourth T should be translation. And that's a term that's used in medicine to talk about taking basic science and putting it into practice. Actually, the polio vaccine invented by Tony Salk was translational medicine. That's why he didn't get the Nobel Prize, because it's just, you know, translation. That's not hard. The really hard part was discovering the causal mechanisms of the polio virus, and once you had that, then, you know, like Einstein said, any fool can figure out what to do with it. And the time will come when this snotty pro-theory, anti-practice attitude will be demolished by growing public recognition of how important it is to figure out how you translate research into practice. And so this session is based on evidence about how to use evidence in policing, putting evidence in frontline policing in the USA. And our presenters will be Professor Cynthia Lung, who is the director of the Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy at George Mason University, with her colleagues, Professor Cody Tellett, formerly of the center, now with Arizona State University, two doctoral students, Julie Greco and Heather Bobak, and then finally, wait for it, Chris Coper Curve Coper. All of those of you who have studied this curve will now get to see not only Chris speaking this morning, but also playing drums. So with no further ado, please welcome Professor Cynthia Long.
Thank you. I need like a Lung line or something like that, that's provocative, you know. Because Coper curve is, if you mention Coper curve to Chris, just say, oh yeah, we don't really use that. It's not that interesting. I was in a presentation once, and people were looking very bored. And I finally mentioned, we have Professor Coper at George Mason now. And everybody lit up, and they said, oh, Coper curve. Like, and they said, who are you? But in any case, good morning, everyone. Larry, thank you very much for inviting us here today. I'm very pleased to represent George Mason University and the Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy from Washington, D.C. And I'm going to shift gears just a little bit today from the first presentation that Larry gave to talk about one of our projects in the center. It's an ongoing project called the Matrix Demonstration Project. It's named after the evidence-based policing matrix. And this project has a number of parallels to some of the goals of the College of Policing, so I hope you'll find it useful in that regard. And in particular, the purpose and the goals of this particular project is to think about how we can institutionalize research into practice, how we can make it more usable and digestible. So I'm going to introduce the panel today, and then we'll have three presentations related to this project. To me, evidence-based policing is not just about generating a high quality supply of research, or synthesis of research, or systematic reviews of research. Very important aspect of evidence-based policing. It's a very important leg of evidence-based policing. But evidence-based policing, to me, is also about the use of that research. It goes very much hand in hand with generating a good quality of supply. And in an ideal world, evidence-based policing is a state of policing in which policies and practices reflect crime prevention principles derived from rigorous research, that at least some decisions include and incorporate scientific outputs and analyses and processes, and that research is at least a part of the conversation about police deployment and strategies, that it's a part of conversations that occur in managerial meetings or part of conversations that are occurring in the street or between supervisors and officers. I think this is much more easily said than done. Even in my definition here, it implies that there's a challenge between this relationship, between the relationship between the supply of research and its demand. I like this analogy of the supply and demand for research. I initially had a huge graph here with a supply and demand curve, and I decided to just reduce it to this equation. But I really like this analogy because it suggests that both affect each other, and both cannot exist without each other. It's very much a part of this equation that makes up evidence-based policing. And like many supply and demand relationships, it suggests that external factors can improve supply, it can shape and create demand, or it can influence the equilibrium that results from, or non-equilibrium that can result from this equation. Things like dissemination and marketing of research, the quality of the product, the receptivity of the consumers of research, whether it be the police or the public or academics. You know, the market environment, the psychology of the players, the infrastructure behind that psychology of the players all matter with regard to the reality that results from this equation of supply and demand for research. So in other words, generating a good supply of research won't on its own achieve evidence-based policing. We have to work equally hard to think about the demand side for research. And in many ways, we've actually worked quite a bit on the supply side. In the evidence-based policing matrix, there are now 120, we've just updated it to be current to December of 2012. There are 125 studies that reach at least a level of 3 on the SMS scale. So there's quite a bit of research on police crime control measures, which is the foundation of the matrix. And I unfortunately don't have time to present on the matrix today. If you want a detailed presentation, there's a number of videos on our website that you can take a look at. We also have training videos related to the matrix that are freely available. But today I want to give you kind of the story of the development of the matrix and how it came to be the matrix demonstration project, because this story emphasizes the challenges with translating research into practice and thinking about why demand is so important. The initial intent of the matrix was trying to create a translation tool that would take the supply of research and make it more digestible, make it more usable and accessible. So not only can officers go into individual dots and look at individual studies and summaries of them, but they can look at different groupings of studies. And the matrix itself is a visual grouping of studies. We found that by binning studies by different aspects of police interventions, what they target, whether or not they're proactive or reactive, whether or not they're focused or general in nature, and by color coding them to their outcomes, we could see some of these generalizations that come from research. It's kind of like a visual systematic review in a sense. Just it's online and you can access different things about it. But we began to see generalizations about different intersections of these dimensions, different typologies, if you will, of policing interventions. And these typologies appear as kind of clusters of studies that give you a sense of, for example, micro-placed, highly proactive, and focused types of strategies. You can take a look at them as examples, et cetera. And these clusterings revealed generalizations from the research that are not new, that did not come just from us. People were talking about it during the Maryland report, during the National Research Council report on effective policing, fair and effective policing strategies. And these generalizations, I'm just putting 3 up here that are really the most, the strongest generalizations that emerge from the research. But we know that officers can be more effective when they are proactive as opposed to reactive. We know that officers are more effective when they tailor or focus their strategies on particular problems. And we know police can be very effective when they focus on places and not just individual people or cases. So if the police can recalibrate their various everyday, not specialized, but their various everyday activities, patrol, investigations, neighborhood policing, offender management, to be more proactive, tailored, and place-oriented, the chances of reducing crime would be much higher for a particular agency. Now, I'm still kind of talking about the matrix in theory. We'll get to the matrix in practice in a minute. But the matrix was intended to be used in different ways by different groups as a translation tool for those interested in translating this body of knowledge into usable forms. For example, researchers and funding agencies, when I talk to them, I often talk about gaps in the matrix, places where we don't have supply, places where the supply needs to be strengthened in terms of where research money might be needed to meet, for example, demand. We have a lot of agencies who are interested in group interventions against gangs, for example. There's very little research in the matrix related to groups and gangs. For agencies, the matrix was intended to guide tactical and strategic development in a variety of ways. For example, one could estimate whether a current strategy or a proposed strategy in a management meeting was in an area of the matrix that might be fruitful in terms of crime control. Or, for example, a first-line supervisor going up for promotion, his or her tendencies or portfolio of deployment strategies could be checked against the matrix in terms of how evidence-based that particular individual was. Of course, given that they were trained in this particular type of policing. Or, for example, one could look at an entire patrol deployment portfolio compared against the evidence in the absence of extensive evaluation. Indeed, this is what Superintendent Howard Vegas, who's in the audience, did in Derbyshire, where he took, I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer on me, but where he took, his 22 patrol deployment strategies that he could identify, map them into the matrix to compare them against a tendency against the research in the matrix. And very interestingly, he found a tendency that, although he did find some strategies that were similar in terms of proactive place-based focus, many of the strategies were also individual-based, reactive, and general in nature. So this is a very interesting discussion, which is going to be published now in Policing in 2013. It's a very interesting application of the matrix, right? Now, a lot of this is kind of what we hope for. Some of it we've tried to test out with different agencies, but it's kind of the matrix in theory. And all of these suggest different ways the research might be used through a translation tool. Well, here lies the problem, okay? The problem is that this is just the beginning. This is scratching at the surface, in my view. Okay? There's only so much that evidence can do to translate itself into practice. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're using the evidence. We're trying to engage with it in some way to translate into practice. But I go back to yesterday's speakers, which was extremely interesting, because each one of them pointed out, especially Alex, pointed out that we are facing much larger challenges with regards to evidence-based policing that need to be considered. One only needs to look at the everyday aspects of policing, at least in the United States, to see how institutionalized the symptoms of a non-evidence-based approach are in policing. Okay? Things such as reliance on reactive beat patrol. Okay? This is like the mainstay of American policing, and it's very much a symptom of a non-evidence-based approach. Reliance on reactive, individual, case-by-case investigations. When I was a detective, we worked on individual cases. We never looked at places or groups of people in any particular way, except for ad hoc reasons. Innovations are viewed as esoteric. They're housed in some specialized unit. We've got problem-solving specialized unit, community-oriented policing specialized unit. It's not institutionalized into the daily practices of policing. There's a continued isolation from other agencies that are required for problem-solving. And problem-solving is not institutionalized in policing. And certainly analytic processes, crime analysis, crime analysts are seen as outsiders in the U.S., even though many of them are very instrumental in developing the evaluations that have led to the evidence that you see in the matrix. So the obstacles suggest that the police, at least in the U.S., have a tendency, and I'm not sure if this is in the cases from the places that you're from, but have a natural tendency towards individualized, general, reactive approaches, the exact opposite of what the evidence seems to tell us. And indeed, research is rarely and only recently becoming the part of everyday conversations of policing. And the reason for this current state that we find ourselves in are many. One, procedures-based policing is incredibly standardized throughout and institutionalized throughout the functions and the roles of police. Training and promotions focuses on these procedures. It's not focused on knowledge, research knowledge, or analytic problem solving. Supervision and leadership reflect this procedure's reactive-based approach to policing and tends to be very passive, very reactive. And experiential knowledge and discretion are overvalued. It trumps scientific knowledge. Mythology, false beliefs, and assertions of politics often influence priorities without, some of them are completely unsubstantiated, okay? And yet they still are very strong movers and drivers of priorities in policing. So, by the way, I put this list up here not to discourage. I put this list up here because I think we have to identify, and it shows the changeable items that we can focus on to increase the chances of greater receptivity for research, analysis, and dynamic learning environments in policing. But to do this, I think we have to tackle the culture, the organizational processes, the infrastructure behind these things that is influencing how strong the demand for research, for evaluation, for evidence, for science is going to be in policing. And we need to think about the infrastructure and the culture behind this to help research stick in policing. Because I don't know about many of you, but as a police officer, when I was a police officer, we don't tend to think about these types of things. We're thinking about many other different things, and I'll get to that in a minute. And so this is what the Matrix Demonstration Project is all about, trying to look at these behind-the-scenes institutions and infrastructures to consider changing existing practices and systems that the police value in order to improve receptivity to research in practice. Again, like I said, I don't think cops and supervisors on the street are thinking about research. I certainly was not thinking about research when I was in patrol or as a detective. It's not something that you tend to focus on. What you focus on are things like procedures, rules, accountability systems, getting promoted, requirements, staying out of trouble, right? General orders. We have to figure out how to institutionalize research into those systems and values, and that's what the Matrix Demonstration is about. It's attempting to do this within existing systems and practices. And basically, the project is about trying out different types of things to see how we can do this. And I just want to give a few examples here that we're working on. When Chris and I visit academies, rarely do they ever talk about things that you can do as a patrol officer to reduce crime. In fact, when I was in Baltimore City, the first time I ever saw a general order, our general orders are 500 pages long, and we had to read every single one of them. The first time I ever saw a general order in those 500 pieces was when we had my fifth commissioner come in, and he actually put a page in the general order that said the police were responsible for reducing crime, and here are the things that we need to think about. That was my fifth commissioner, who was subsequently arrested and had to go to federal prison. But nonetheless, the vision was there, I guess. Just in control of things. So one thing we're focused on is creating hour-long modules that look like academy modules, that look like in-service modules, but focus on the research, the evidence, training. We have a module available if you want to look at it called Crime Analysis for Commanders. Why is crime analysis so key for commanders to understand in relation to evidence-based policing, for example? Okay. We've taken field training systems and turned them into the same field training system, but underlying the activities are activities that are more reflective of the evidence. So the system of field training stays the same. It's a bit subversive, I guess. But yet we think about, well, how can we swap out certain activities? How can we swap out certain requirements so that they reflect the evidence more? A good example of this is one requirement of field training in many police agencies in the United States is something called geography. Does anybody know what I'm talking about when I say this? Some of the cops in the room do. Like, you're graded on geography. What does that mean? That you know where you're going, right? That you know your beat. Like, do you know, like, what the streets are and which ways are one-way streets and et cetera, right? Well, how about the geography of crime, right? That would be more interesting, more evidence-based to be graded on in terms of field training. And so we make these little adjustments in the broader system so that it's more aligned with the research. I'm going to skip over this because Chris is going to talk about patrol deployment. But we have something, a tool called Case of Places, where we take an entire investigative case folder. Many of you were detectives in the past, right? You fill out a case folder. There's all these requirements on what to do about suspects. Did you do X, Y, Z? There's checklists. We take those same checklists and simply convert the unit of investigation from a person to a place. And then we convert every single aspect of that. But yet we keep the status of detectives. We keep the case folder approach because detectives are used to that. Right, so it's just investigating something different that is more aligned with the third principle of evidence-based policing, that places can be more fruitful. I've already talked about a little bit about how the matrix can be used to adjust promotions, rewards, assessments. But again, this is part of the matrix demonstration project where we're thinking about how these things can occur, making managerial meetings more engaging with the research. We have something called CompStat in the U.S. It's all about, like, today's stats are this, and last week's stats were that, and we had a change, so what are you doing about it? Well, how about engage a little bit more, have a conversation about what does the research say about what you should do about that? So we've got demonstrations focused on that, using short video clips to prompt managerial meetings to think about research. And finally, cops work in an environment of procedures more than abstract concepts. They're just developing how-to guides on doing evaluations, how to do hotspots policing, how to change a random reactive patrol approach to one that is more place-based. In conclusion, because we're academics, we also focus in this project on the science of translation. So who knows if the matrix is useful? I don't know. We have to test it, right? From a scientific perspective. And so this also includes identifying translation tools. For example, I think the Koper curve is a translation tool. It helps police understand a piece of research using a time cue, essentially, that is very familiar to cops on the street. Okay? Time is something that is very familiar to a police officer, to a patrol officer. And so what are these translation tools? Who are the translators in the police? Are they first-line supervisors? Are they crime analysts? What? Right, determining which of these tools work best, what organizational factors facilitate translation, what structural features are necessary for translation. So my colleagues are all here today to give you just bits and pieces of the Matrix Demonstration Project and some of the things we're thinking about. Cody's going to talk about receptivity of research and policing. Julie and Heather are going to talk about the practitioner police partnerships that are behind the matrix evaluations. And Chris is going to get into the weeds a little bit about calibrating hotspots for more evidence-based patrol deployment. So Cody, let me invite you up here to begin receptivity discussion.